Hello, and welcome to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. I'm your host, America's managing editor for InfraLogic, Jonathan Carmody. Today, we're excited to welcome Michael Hockenadel, who is managing director and head of digital infrastructure at Harrison Street Asset Management. Michael, welcome to the episode.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm very excited to be here. We have a lot to talk about today.
Indeed. Just to give some background on Michael and his role with the firm, Michael, as I said, is head of digital at Harrison Street, based out of San Francisco. The firm itself is headquartered in Chicago. Michael joined the firm in 2020, and prior to that, worked for around 12 years at JLL. Michael, as you said, there's a lot to talk about in the digital infrastructure space, but before we dig into the questions, could you just give us an overview of your role with the business?
Sure. Yeah, so I joined the business at Harrison Street 6 years ago to really help lead and grow our efforts in data centers and digital infrastructure. As a firm, Harrison Street has been around for about 20 years, really focused on what I would describe as real estate alternatives, the categories of the broader real estate and infrastructure landscape that are both operationally intensive, such that there are barriers to entry, but also things that tend to be supported by positive, persistent demand fundamentals. So things like student housing and senior living were at the forefront early, and over time, we've added various things. Obviously, we added data centers and digital along the way, and it's become a major focus of the firm for obvious reasons. Prior to that, I was on the sell side, originally with the Staubach company and then JLL through the merger of those firms. So interestingly, I did my first data center deal over 20 years ago now in 2005. Very different market back then, and it's been fun to observe the ways in which the market has evolved over the years.
In terms of how Harrison Street invests in the digital infrastructure and particularly in the data center space, we've seen a lot of individual acquisitions of data centers. Do you have also a platform strategy as well at Harrison Street? I wonder if you could talk through some of the Sure. ways that Harrison Street invests in the space.
So typically, we are investors at the project level, and that's really consistent across all of the different strategies that we pursue as a firm. We are very partner-oriented, and so essentially, when we form a partnership with a group, we tend to execute programmatic transactions across a consistent strategy with those groups, and we very much have done that in the data center space, really across a variety of different sub-strategies that we find interesting. And so at this point in time, we have about five or six different operating partners that we're working closely with across the landscape. We can invest at the platform level. In a couple of different circumstances, we have done that over time, but the typical profile is a project level joint venture where we are investing project level equity.
So to zoom out a little bit then, Michael, at the 30,000 foot level, data centers are often described as the hottest asset class in real estate and in infrastructure. And that's certainly true at the moment with the amount of activity that we're seeing, the scale of some of the transactions out there in the markets, whether it's enormous greenfield builds for hyperscalers or some of the incredible multi-billion dollar M&A transactions that are out there. From your perspective, what convinces you that this is a durable macro-driven demand story and not a development bubble as some people fear in the industry?
Yeah, I think that it's clearly the best place to start in a conversation like this, and you can attack it from a variety of different perspectives. But the reality is that we are just in a moment that is defined by profound demand, and that demand is driven by the confluence of a variety of underlying elements that are happening simultaneously. And this is something that we've been talking about really for 5 or 6 years now. And it seems to be accelerating for some very important reasons that we can get into. Take a step back, and we'll start by setting aside AI. We'll obviously spend a lot of time talking about AI. That's sort of been the more recent phenomenon that everybody is focusing on. But even if you set aside AI and look at what the underlying market fundamentals have been over the last several years, it's really been solid and consistent demand growth, driven largely by the public cloud companies. For each of them, their cloud businesses had been the primary source of growth and profitability for those companies. you kind of layer on top of that things like content distribution and the trend increasingly seeing various types of media property delivered over the internet versus broadcast. And so you already had incredibly strong demand fundamentals growing at somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 40% per year. And then on top of that, you layer on AI, right? And so AI has obviously changed things dramatically. And I think as that started to happen, you started to hear noise from people about whether or not there would be any reality to the future of AI in terms of persisting, as you describe. And so I think many of us in the industry and many people generally are starting to have their kind of aha moments in terms of what AI could become and what it could do to the markets going forward. But when the first broadly disseminated ChatGPT model hit a couple of years ago, I think it was interesting because it clearly was a step function change from anything that had happened before it. It was sort of fun to play with. It could create some interesting text content. Really wasn't all that useful practically yet. So it was really more of a curiosity than anything. And since that point in time, you've seen consistent evolution from the models put out by OpenAI. You've seen other companies start to put out models that seemed to be competitive in terms of their quality and robustness, and then each incrementally, you know, improved over time. And then I feel like earlier this year, maybe somewhere in the February timeframe, with the most recent model releases from the dominant companies, we started to see a whole nother step function change in terms of how powerful and robust these models are. And it started to jump into a new category where the future productivity just started to become obvious for anybody using these models. And so I certainly had an aha moment like that myself. I was already a big believer in how they were going to impact the future, but it was really enhanced and cemented as I started to use the latest versions of the models. And I think a couple of things follow from that that are really important in terms of thinking about the demand that will follow. For starters, I think it's important to understand that interacting with an AI model requires vastly more compute resources than other types of compute, certainly than search or the other more kind of static things that you might do on the internet. So that's one important point. And I think the second important point is that it's now clear to me, at least if we have the infrastructure to support it, that everything that you do with a computer will involve AI at some point going forward. It's just that powerful. So whereas historically, you would create a PowerPoint from scratch in PowerPoint, now you can just ask your AI agent to do that for you. And in fact, actually iterate through changes and developments and iterations on its own before it comes back to you with something looking like a finished product. And that applies to things that you might do, you know, financial modeling in Excel or otherwise. It starts to become very clear what the impact on demand will be going forward as use cases proliferate, commercialization proliferates, and AI becomes an important backbone of how we interface with computers.
Excellent. And we've all seen a lot of the success stories, companies like Oracle, Meta, and the other hyperscalers developing enormous multi-hundred megawatt, now moving perhaps into the gigawatt scale campuses. And I'm just thinking, but when you look at some of these projects, Michael, and when you're considering an investment for your portfolio, what is it you're looking for in terms of the metrics of the projects that you're looking at? What's the sweet spot for Harrison Street when you find a project, there's an investment opportunity either through an auction or you've identified the asset somehow? What are the key criteria that you're considering when you want to make an investment?
I think a couple of different things. For starters, it depends on what we're targeting from a return perspective. We manage capital across a variety of different fund products. In total, we're managing about $108 billion in assets under management. That's in different products across the risk spectrum. And so It depends whether we're targeting opportunistic, more core style returns. But I would say that regardless, what we're focused on is attributes that we think make underlying projects more strategic and less of a commodity in nature. I think one of the dynamics that you're seeing play out across the industry right now is a rush to build bulk compute in very large chunk sizes. And so in certain circumstances, going to non-traditional locations, very tertiary locations, generally anywhere that you can get the power and permitting, whether grid power behind the meter at scale required to build those compute campuses. I think for us, we tend to be a little bit more leery of those locations that we see as being more commodity locations. We really focus on underlying connectivity and proximity to end users and other data center clusters from a latency standpoint. I think from our perspective, not that there's a bubble. I don't think there's a bubble. And honestly, I think that the larger campuses are likely to be fine over time. But I think many of them cater to this moment in time where the AI models require quite a bit of compute for training. I think over time, you're going to see a shift from training to inference, inference being the portion of the compute that is serving up operational use cases for end users. We do believe that there's a tighter latency requirement on those types of applications. And we think that connectivity and proximity to end users, which is to suggest maybe more distributed, smaller campuses closer to metropolitan areas, could be an interesting place to deploy going forward. And then with respect to campuses, we still are focused on locations that we think are well sorted that support a diversity of use cases, whether that's AI training, inference, cloud, content distribution, or otherwise. And so I think the other place to go with the question, which kind of circles back to risk tolerance and return thresholds, is end user profile. The landscape has evolved dramatically in that category. A lot of the story centered around the primary hyperscale cohort historically, and that is still the case to some extent, but you're seeing a whole array of new players that are increasingly becoming important parts of the market, some with large balance sheets, but not credit yet, others emerging credit, others non-investment grade, being able to price and structure around credit in a way that makes sense from a return standpoint would be the other key place to focus.
I think that's a really important point you made there. Obviously, we're all familiar with the hyperscalers that are definitely anchoring the vast bulk of the data center development that we're seeing out there. But we are very much witnessing a kind of a broadening of the tenant universe. How do you think about underwriting projects with demand from AI model developers, some of the neo clouds that we're starting to see, and other kind of non-traditional users? I'm trying to think about how different their behavior is when it comes to things like the contract length, expansion rights, or as you mentioned, their credit rating. How do those things factor into your decision making?
Yeah, so there are probably four categories to think about, maybe five, but they overlap a little bit. The first is the hyperscale community, and that's easy. But just to be specific, I think as it relates to our market, it's really Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Meta, and then Oracle would be a fifth, but they're a little bit different, you know, than the others, you know, just from a credit and balance sheet standpoint. So that's one category, largely well understood and quite a bit of information to kind of anchor to around pricing that cohort, both from an equity and debt standpoint. I think the next category is the model companies directly, which increasingly in my mind are definitely different than the neoclouds. I think this kind of circles back to some of the commentary on just how important the models will be going forward. I think that the groups that are establishing themselves as the companies that have the best models, really being Anthropic and OpenAI, while not conventionally investment grade companies yet, my personal view is that they will be investment grade in relatively short order. And not only will they be investment grade, but I think they're going to leap into that hyperscale category in terms of just overall market capitalization. I personally believe those companies are going to be two of the largest, most influential, most important, best capitalized companies in the world in a matter of probably months, not years. And you're starting to see that in real time, just in terms of each fundraising round, when you start to see a little bit about run rate revenue. I mean, they're growing so fast. And again, this is my personal view, not necessarily that the house view, but I do think that you're going to see some incredible things from those companies. And then the next category would be the neoclouds. I would say that much more of a mixed bag in terms of really digging into credit underwriting characteristics. I think that most of them obviously are trying to respond very aggressively and swiftly to take advantage of the current market opportunity. Many of them have origins in the crypto and coin mining space. And so I think there's a risk tolerance there that's comfortable with being aggressive to scale. And there's an aptitude that's oriented around delivering infrastructure quickly. So I think there are definitely going to be some strong winners in that category. And particularly the groups that have established relationships with some of the larger chip manufacturers and some of the hyperscalers or model companies, either as vendor or supplier or investor or tenant. One interesting observation in terms of one of the nuances to the market is just the overlapping roles and complicated relationships that are starting to emerge across these different groups. And then you still have significant demand from enterprise customers, conventional enterprises, financial services companies, et cetera, that increasingly need more compute. In many cases, they've been kind of crowded out of markets because of the growth of cloud and AI. Many of them, for regulatory or security reasons, want to control their own compute environment. And so we're increasingly seeing demand from that cohort as well. And then I would say, lastly, operators, which in some cases could be competitors, could potentially be customers, just as everybody is trying to secure as much capacity as possible in as many venues as possible. And so that would be kind of the fifth category. So that's kind of the way we think about framing the end user landscape. And it's an exciting time to be providing solutions to many of the groups across those different cohorts, just given the wave of demand we're seeing.
Yeah, I think something really interesting is, as you talked about, with kind of the investment grade versus non-investment grade clients. Obviously, all of the hyperscalers are very much investment grade, and the neoclouds are still not there yet. Most of them rated around kind of B minus, double B minus, or B plus. But their project-specific bonds are pricing better and getting better ratings. I think one of the last CoreWeave project bonds, $38.5 billion rating, got something like an A3 rating from Moody's. So moving into the investment grade territory. As you said before, we've got a lot to talk about. So I wanted to move on some of the constraints facing the industry and how you're tackling those. You know, on the supply side, constraints are often talked about in broad terms. Where do you see the most acute bottlenecks today? Power availability, zoning, entitlements, or interconnection? And how do those risks differ by the different markets you operate in?
So every input that goes into building data centers is constrained. I think that's the first place to start. More constrained probably depends on the market, but I think the two really to focus on are the two that you highlighted, which are power and zoning. Starting with power, so one interesting anecdote that I heard recently, if you look forward 10 years from now, there are market participants that I've had conversations with that expect the U.S. data center market to be 300 to 500 gigawatts in 10 years. Depending on how you measure it as we sit here today, order of magnitude, that's somewhere in the neighborhood of a tenfold increase. And it seems just unfathomable if I made a comment like that 5 or 6 years ago. And yet, when I make that comment now, generally, whoever I'm talking to just nods their head and says, yeah, that seems right. Big picture, there's just not utility power available to support that, obviously. So I think a couple of things. I think increasingly everybody in the market is thinking through how to either work towards some form of on-site generation, work in partnership with utility providers to bring new load, new generation to a region. And so in many ways, I would say the data center business is merging with the power business. just based on scale. I can tell you across our portfolio, both things that we're currently working on, as well as new pursuits, some form of on-site generation is popping up in most cases, certainly of cases where you're talking about significant scale. Because of that, I would say the acceptance of on-site generation from the end user community, you're starting to see that adoption as well. And there are a variety of different technologies. It's all typically oriented around some form of a natural gas solution. So whether it's turbines or recips or fuel cells, that is definitely becoming a part of the paradigm. Also for us, and this kind of circles back to some of the inference needs, we are finding situations where we can unlock kind of stranded utility power off of distribution circuits. So in that kind of 30 to 70 megawatt chunk size. And we find that really interesting because in a lot of cases, we're able to effectuate an impressive speed to market or around that utility power. And in many cases, I think those opportunities have been overlooked as groups have chased scale. I had a conversation recently with a group where I was sharing some of our availability. And in that context, 200 megawatts was kind of too small to get their attention, which again is just striking how much things have changed in just a couple of years as campuses have moved up market in terms of scale power. I think the other category you asked about is zoning and entitlement. I would say that this one's much more nuanced. As an industry, we collectively have not done a very good job of presenting a unified, consistent, and positive face to the communities in which we operate. And so this narrative has emerged that big bad data centers are coming and, you know, taking all of your power and water. And so I think it's important that as industry market participants, we articulate the things that can be really beneficial in terms of having data centers be a part of your overall planning and community. I would highlight a couple of different things. I think first and foremost on the power side, end users and developers are focused on bringing new capacity online. Long term, that will help to create more robust, better priced power, more reliable grid across all users and industries. From a design and efficiency standpoint, there's been a lot of focus on designing data centers in a way that is much more efficient around water consumption. And so those things that you hear that might be negative towards data centers are things that we're very focused on. I would say just from a visual design as well, increasingly, we're putting a lot of emphasis on designing data centers that are appealing and attractive and fit well within the landscape of a community. What's unequivocally positive is the economic benefit that a community can derive from data centers. If you just think about the positive tax impact, I think the most obvious example is Loudoun County, where the taxes that they receive from data centers, both property taxes and sales tax, largely support the totality of their budget. And also, unlike residential or other uses or heavier industrial with a lot of traffic, they're not a drag on resources. And so you drive around Loudoun County and look at the public schools, and you can see where a lot of that tax revenue goes. You go to New Albany, Ohio, which also has become a very important data center cluster, and you drive back by the public schools and you see the beneficiary of that economic impact. And while in some cases there's a knock on data centers relative to long-term permanent jobs, you know, the reality is there are an incredible amount of construction jobs created. There are some important and well-paid operational jobs that persist. And then over time, inevitably, there's ongoing construction activity around the expansion of buildings or refreshing gear. And so I think it's a much more positive story than many casual observers understand. And so there are some important initiatives to further articulate that through organizations like ULI and otherwise.
Certainly. I think I wanted to just pick up on one of the points you made there about the generation, the power constraint. A few years ago, when I asked someone in the data center space if they thought that data center developers would start owning their own power generation sources, they kind of laughed it off and said, no, really, these are very different skill sets. Now we're seeing, especially with the larger asset managers who have existing investments in those spaces, there is a little bit more of a crossover now, a bit more of a convergence between the power and data center markets. Michael, as a final point, I wanted to talk a little bit about capital formation in the space. Now, last year, you raised at Harrison Street the HS Digital Fund specifically for investments in the space. We're seeing AI funds raised by some of the major managers. And obviously, there's all of those issues around land, power, and entitlements and everything else in the space. But how are we looking at that complexity? How has it reshaped how capital is formed for the sector, especially in the infrastructure lens, and the types of investors beyond yourselves that are showing up in the market trying to get a piece of the pie?
Yeah, so it's interesting, kind of circling back to the last conversation on constraints. In some ways, you know, you could add capital to that too. Capital is obviously an important part of the overall picture. And you're now starting to see capital formation take place in a variety of different profiles to support both the development projects that are necessary. And what's interesting is we've been in this wave of the development phase of the cycle, and the first projects now are needing liquidity. And so you're starting to see some interesting evolution in terms of new forms of stabilized capital being created to recapitalize or acquire some of these stabilized assets. And I think it's almost like you're seeing a large-scale sector rotation where the data center asset class is emerging as a core asset class. Some people view it as infrastructure. Some people view it as real estate. Some people view it as a combination of the two. I think others are just dropping the descriptors altogether and just describing it as digital assets or real assets. Part of that dovetails with reducing allocations to other sectors, largely other real estate sectors that may be facing long-term structural trends that are somewhat unfavorable. So you're seeing that rotation evolve in real time. You're seeing some creative structures emerge to address the sheer scale of the individual assets in our category. And so that's things like continuation vehicles, for example, yield cos, situations where groups are able to recycle capital from more development-oriented return profile capital into long-term stabilized perpetual capital in a structure wrapper where they're able to maintain operating control and the recapitalization is done behind the scenes. I think that's a trend that you'll see more and more going forward. I think that structure combined with some groups tapping the public markets could be something that you start to see going forward. I started my career really focused on net leased assets, sale-leasebacks, build-to-suit, net lease transactions, CTL financing, and did my first data center deals within that construct. Increasingly, the data center deals today are swinging back into that net lease construct, and in part because of the financing efficiency that it creates. And so you're seeing a lot of structured net lease capital become oriented around the sector as well. And we think that's a trend that you'll continue to see. And then if you look at the debt side, you know, not surprisingly, it's been one of the most, if not the most liquid asset class out there. I think largely predicated on the just unbelievable kind of positive underlying demand fundamentals. And similar to what we talked about on the equity side, you're seeing debt capital come into the market from groups on one side that maybe look at the asset more from a real estate perspective. On the stabilized side, that would be the CMBS market. And also groups that look at it more from the infrastructure side. And you're seeing that from the ABS market. Similar on the construction side, you're seeing project finance lenders overlapping significantly with traditional kind of commercial real estate mortgage lenders. And so it's interesting. And I think in many ways, again, just given the sheer scale of the opportunity from where we sit, a lot of the business honestly really is around capital formation, making sure that you've got both adequate liquidity to take advantage of the opportunity set in front of you, and then capital structured in a way that gives you the flexibility to take advantage of the complexity of the underlying deals and inevitably the growth opportunity that emerges. I think in almost everything that we're doing, the business plan gets larger, additional phases become actionable, the quantum of capital required to support a project inevitably ends up becoming more significant. Most of that tied to positive things that are happening at the project. But that's been an interesting dynamic to track.
Certainly. And we'll continue to track it here at Infralogic over the coming months and years. Michael, thank you so much for the time today. As we said at the start, there were certainly many things to talk about. And we could spend a lot longer talking about these things and other aspects of the industry. But let's save that for the next recording.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed it. I knew 30 minutes would not be enough. So we'll put another one on the calendar.
We should do that. Michael, thanks again for joining the podcast. I'm signing off for today. This is Jonathan Carmody at Infralogic. This podcast is available anywhere where you get your podcasts, and we look forward to hearing more feedback on your thoughts on the industry. So thanks again to our guest, Michael Hockenadel.
Thank you.